I'm here today with Diane Elliott and Souther, co-conspirators in this wonderful art book called Art and Inspiration. Can you give me a little idea about what the book's about and your process of writing it?
The book is... Originally, my daughter asked me to write her biography, and I said, you don't want your mother to write your biography, believe me. And we left it at that. And then one day she called me up from a trip that she was taking from South Dakota, wasn't it?
South Dakota through the eastern badlands of Wyoming.
Right. And she called me up and she said, Mom, I've got it. I have the inspiration, and you're always asking me where the inspiration for my materials are. And what did you say?
While I was driving through eastern Wyoming, there were sun dogs dancing in the clouds, and they inspired me to dream of a necklace called Sun Dog. But I was visioning that with the beads, and I didn't want to lose what I was seeing. So I picked up my app on the phone, and I recorded what I was thinking about. I was recording the bead colors I would use and how I wanted to layer them to capture this image that I was seeing in the sky. And of course, eastern Wyoming, you have zero cell phone coverage. So you have a lot of windshield time, which is just the thinking time. And the phone call didn't come until many hours later.
And when she called, I said, now that would make a book. That would make a book worth that somebody could read and that I could help write. So that was the beginning.
So then you two decided to take a road trip of how many days?
3 weeks, 7,500 miles. And it was a, air quotes, marketing trip that we went from place to place selling jewelry and little bits of fused glass that I had made.
Into buttons.
And we were going to go across the country. And as we were marketing, we would visit family across the country. And mother would accompany me, and she could write while I drove.
So
this has all the ingredients of a disaster, but it ended up the most beautiful art book that I've read in a long time. I mean, putting it down, I was expecting when I read it to see descriptions of art and your inspiration. But this is a fully inspirational book. It has a lot of philosophical thought in it. It's just a lovely, multi-layered book. And it's in Souther's voice. How did you do that,
well,
Diane?
I would write, and I'd ask her questions like, well, what inspired you to do this? And she'd tell me about the materials she used or what inspired her to use it. And then... it would lead us into talking about her life. So it becomes a little bit of a biography also. Mm-hmm. So I would then write as best I could what she was telling me, kind of mostly in my style. And I would read it back. She said, Mom, I wouldn't use that word. Mom, I wouldn't say it that way. How would you say it? And I'd change it. How would you use it? And that's how I got her voice, is because I was listening to her voice.
Sitting right there in the car.
Yes, yes.
Wonderful. Tell me more.
Well, as you said, it could have been a recipe for disaster.
Mm-hmm.
My mother does not do well in heavy traffic.
To say the least.
And any time a car... from outside comes swooping by, she gets very uptight and nervous, which of course translate into a driver going, ah! and so when I would see that we were coming into heavy traffic, I'd say, Mom, start typing. Look at your computer.
Keep your eyes on the computer.
Because if she would focus on the computer, she wasn't focused on the traffic. And to keep her focused on the computer and not on the traffic helped for a very smooth drive rather than an upset.
So you could focus on the story.
We could focus on the story. Mm-hmm. And I could focus on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And this worked well because, well, basically, we're both adventurous and we're both verbal, so that's how it worked.
Tell me about the photos a little bit. The photographs are just such an integral, beautiful
part of this. Griffith took those photographs. Yes, she's local, and she's a marvelous photographer and editor. And Souther would bring her jewelry to her, and she would take these wonderful pictures that are in the book. And she also helped with the font and
layout.
And
we thought we had a gorgeous and great layout, and then we sent it to Art Book Printing in Michigan. And I had been talking to the founder of Art Book Printing for a few weeks and talking back and forth about what he could do for me and what my book was about. And we had had many, many long conversations. And when, he had said, well, we could do this, but it'll cost you X amount more. I'm going, well, how about if you just throw it in? You know, this is a fundraiser for macular degeneration. Can you throw that much of it in? And sight unseen, I convinced him to throw in a little bit of the manufacture of the book and reduce my cost a little bit. And after I got off the phone, I was thinking, wow, he doesn't even know what he agreed to. And so I called him back. I said, Ring, you haven't seen the book yet, have you? He said, no, I haven't. I said, would you like to see what you got yourself into? He said, yes, I really would. So I sent him a PDF of the book and the layout and the design. And I didn't hear back from him for a few days. When I did hear back from him, he's stammering a little bit. He's not quite sure how to approach me. And I'm going, we've had enough conversations. Just spit it out. He said, oh, the layout could do, it just is not doing your book justice. He said, your work is so beautiful. With just a few modifications and refinement, this will make everything look like $1 million. Can I show you what I'm talking about? I said, certainly. You know, I can't afford any more, though. And so he sent me the first 9 pages. After he had taken them from the PDF, he tweaked them, and it really did just add the punch that we were lacking. And it taught Linda and myself so much. I mean, we went from really good to really great, I feel. And some of the details of the book that the layperson is not going to even think. It's a subconscious thing, but that subconscious, it filters into that subconscious as something rich. And some of the things he did was the fades. On the pages that have a small picture that doesn't fill the page, he took a color from the picture and he faded the color from light to dark to the edge, which sets the picture nicely on the page.
Like a frame.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something I would have never thought of doing.
The other thing he did was he chose that color, a deeper version of that color, and the font, the title became that color, as well as the first letter, the glyph of that first letter of the story, which enriches the story. And each one is not just a color at random. It picks up a color from the piece of jewelry. And that sets up a feeling in that book, a feeling of richness that the previous version was lacking, because we had no concept of this. But man, do we understand that now.
And that's, again, I had not noticed, but you're right, it sort of seeped into my unconscious, because it is a very rich book visually.
Yes.
And then the other thing, I don't know if he had anything to do with that, was the first paragraph, it's simply written, the first paragraph talks about the jewelry sometimes.
That's what we did together, all of us.
And then the bottom part talks about a memory you have, or a person that you know, or something, so it ties it all in together. that, so beautifully.
That was the format of the book that we had envisioned.
So he did the more visual.
He did the visual punch, and we had the stories were already there,
and the photography was fabulous.
Mm-hmm. He absolutely loved the photography, but look at the purple in the monarch and the purple of the S, the glyph of the S, and it matches the jewelry here. The one thing our photographer, Linda, did was a little bit of photoshopping. Mm-hmm. So on this page, you'll see there's a picture of me when I'm 10. The dress I was wearing was an ugly red plaid.
It was.
And it really was not pleasing on the page. It fought with the jewelry. Uh-huh. But when she said, oh, I can fix that with a little tweak of Photoshop, all of a sudden, now that's a dress I wish I really had when I was 10 years old.
Lovely alteration. Things that you don't think of that go into a book that make it a beautiful piece of art in and of itself. It's amazing.
The craftsmanship that goes in, the thought that goes into it, it's not just, I'm going to put these words on paper and print them and give them to somebody.
I think the other reason that the book works, another reason, is when Linda and Souther and I were working together, we often, somebody would say, that's not quite right, or I don't care for that word, or I don't care for that color, or there's something wrong. We'd go through, somebody would make a suggestion. Well, what about this? And I'm like, no, I don't care for that. What about this? But when somebody said, how about, and we all agreed, we said, bingo, that's it. And our egos were in the product. Mm-hmm. We all have ego, but our egos were invested in the product. And whenever a group invests their ego in the product, it comes out much better.
That's an interesting and wonderful comment, because another thing I got out of the book was little pieces of wry wit, which were wonderful, which you also don't expect in an art book, but also little bits of philosophy like that. When a group sets aside their ego for a larger project, it works beautifully. And there's more in the book, and I wish I'd taken out pieces, because it really did leave me when I was finished feeling inspired and somehow generous, and I don't know why.
Well, you're an artist too, and so maybe that has something to do with it.
I suspect it's more in the whole work of this incredible book. Earlier you mentioned macular degeneration and that the profits were going to be going into a fund concerning macular degeneration. Can you talk a bit about that?
I was diagnosed with macular degeneration first, actually, when I was 41 years old. But the doctor diagnosing me had passed it off very passe, and something that I didn't need to worry about until I was much, much older. 10 years later, that eye doctor was no longer my eye doctor because he retired. And I found a new eye doctor who is seeing something in the back of my eye and becoming very concerned and wanting my charts from my old eye doctor, which we were able to get. And he, you know, had me come in a couple of times. He said, well, you've got macular degeneration, and I'm really concerned that you've only got about 2 to 10 years of decent eyesight left because it's progressing. And I think I spent a couple of weeks feeling sorry for myself. I think a lot of people would, especially when the visual is so important to their life. And then I put my big girl panties on, and I said, what am I going to do about it? And I've learned as much as I can about macular degeneration, and new things are being discovered daily. But also funding for some projects are being canceled because they just don't have the money to continue the research.
And don't you think that's partly because it's not very sexy? You don't die from it.
I don't die. Nobody's going to die from macular degeneration. It's a disease for old people.
Your soul can
go. Your soul can go, but you're not going to die from it. And who cares about old people? We live in a young person society. Mm-hmm. So who cares if an old person can see or can't see? You know, they get help. They can get around. They can manage. It's not the young child dying of leukemia. Let's solve that. It doesn't have the marketing appeal. It doesn't have the heartstring appeal. But the thing with macular degeneration is that if you live long enough, everybody may be affected. The people that are never affected by macular degeneration are the ones that have died too soon.
They die early.
And so if you think about what is my life going to be like when I get old, do you want to live in a world that you can see, or do you want to live in a world where you have a hard time, difficulty maneuvering because you can't see? And it doesn't affect your peripheral vision so much as it affects your central vision. Mm-hmm. So the faces that you see right in front of you, you cannot distinguish the face. Mm-hmm. You have to start really relying on hearing.
And so we need research.
We need research, and we need funding for research. And that's one of the things I thought. I don't have anything to give to research, but maybe I can write a book and sell the book and raise money for research.
So where had the research money been coming from that was cut? Is that a federal funding problem?
Some of it's federal. Some of it's just, you know, some people in their will leave endowments to go to research. So funding comes from all over. But unless you're educated or have an understanding that, hey, I want to support this, it doesn't get supported.
Well, but the federal funding has gone way down.
Federal funding for lots of things have gone way down.
Right.
And it's relying on privatization.
Mm-hmm. How has that affected your art? It's just heartbreaking to hear of an artist who can't see as well as they'd want to.
I no longer work in the flame.
What is the flame?
The flame is I used to work in the flame and make lamp work beads.
It sounds very exciting. What is the flame?
The last bead in the book is
my last bead. And the flame is, it's a torch, typically an oxyacetylene torch or a hot, you can use a MAP gas. And the torch, you use a mandrel and a torch, and you put glass and a mandrel in the fire and you create and form beads. What I discovered is that I can no longer see what's happening to the glass. Glass gets molten hot and red. Mm-hmm. But things like flares happen and different things happen in that red glass that my eyes can't pick up any longer. Mm-hmm. And what I discovered working with another friend who works in glass is that she was seeing things that I wasn't seeing in the glass. So what that means is I'm not able to know when to stop a process or when to continue a process. And a lot of the beads that were coming out just by intuition and not by design. Mm-hmm. When I did that and I understood that I wasn't seeing everything, I was thinking, what is this doing to my eyes? What is looking into this flame doing to my eyes? Mm-hmm. Is it going to harm them or not? I mean, we wear protective glasses, but is that enough? And I decided that I should preserve my eyes and not take that risk. Mm-hmm. And seeing as I wasn't seeing as well as I should be seeing, I gave that up. Mm-hmm. So now I find great glasswork that's done by other people and sometimes incorporate that into my work. I still do fused glass because I'm not looking in a flame. I'm not looking at the glass melting. I know pretty much what's going to happen when I melt this glass and this glass together, two different glasses together. But there's a lot of surprises that happen in infused glass, which are very fun. Mm-hmm. I still bead. I have taught many people how to thread the needle blind, which is a technique that I've developed where I don't need to see the end of the thread to thread a needle.
Sounds very zen-like.
And, well, the eye of a beading needle is very tiny. Mm-hmm. And even young people have a hard time seeing it. So let's get a new technique on threading that needle, and I can do it without looking. Hmm. And so I'm developing things like that. I don't know if I'll be able to bead forever, but I'll bead for as long as I can. Mm-hmm. And as my girlfriend told me, you're an artist no matter what, sighted or unsighted, and your art will, we don't know what it's going to be, but it will develop.
Mm-hmm. The other thing is she's done a lot of things for her eyes from her research, and it has to do with diet, and it has to do with wearing dark glasses that even on the sides block out the light.
Sunlight is not your friend.
Really?
Yes. We think that we want our eyes to expand and contract, and I always thought I wanted my eyes to adjust to different lighting situations and the muscles to keep working. But the UV rays on your eyes can damage the macula. And so it's recommended that you wear I call them my diva shades, right? So that no light, so that the light doesn't come into the eye and, mm-hmm. and do any damage. I've been wearing those for quite a number of years now. And I eat, I've read a lot of books on what to eat, and there's a lot of different, I don't take the vitamins. I really try to get all of my nutrients from my food. So I eat orange peppers every week. Orange peppers, the phytochemicals in orange peppers are found to be beneficial to the eye health. Not green peppers, not red peppers, orange peppers. The phytochemicals in kiwis. So there's blueberries. It really is a natural, healthy, all well-balanced food that I eat.
And very colorful.
And
your necklaces are so full of color and vitality. You're eating vitality and color.
Yeah.
I love that.
So it really wasn't a big change of eating, mm-hmm. but I don't think I have had a fast food meal since my second diagnosis.
And you think that's being helpful then, your change of diet and so on?
I do.
Really?
It's been 7 years, 8 years. Yeah.
And how many years since they said you only gave you 2 to 10
about
years?
About 7, 8 years. 7 years, 8 years. And what I have, okay, I had to take an eye exam for my driver's license. And I only tell this story because it tells me that I do have damage that I compensate for. I mm-hmm. think that because I'm visual, mm-hmm. one eye compensates for the other and the other eye, they compensate for each other where there's holes. But when I had my eyes to the machine that they say, tell me what the signs are. I'm reading all the signs, da 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 da. I read everything I could see, and I lifted my head away from the machine, and that gave me enough distance that my left eye looked over to where my right eye was supposed to be looking, and I saw some signs, and the woman at the same time said, you haven't finished, there's still one more row. So I put my head back down. I couldn't see, but my left eye had picked it up, and I was able to tell her what she wanted to hear. And I passed my eye exam.
Great story.
But that tells me that when I isolate my eyes, yeah. I have holes in my vision.
Uh-huh.
But when my eyes are working together, they compensate for those holes.
Wonderful. Fabulous. Teamwork.
Wonderful.
So tell me, we haven't really talked much about the jewelry. And in this book, it's all necklaces, collars almost, except for a few rings in the back and a couple of bracelets. So tell me about, I mean, they're complex. I can't imagine how you strung all those tiny beads into these amazing weavings. Spider Woman weavings. Incredible. Layering of beauty. Go ahead.
You talk about Zen, and there's something Zen-like about having a pile of beads, maybe several piles of beads of different colors, and having a thread and a needle and just picking beads up one at a time and stringing them together and weaving. It's called off-loom bead weaving. So weaving different patterns. And there's different techniques. But a lot of my techniques are making square or triangles or, you know, forming them into these patterns and then adding on to them. But there's something very Zen-like about that, very quieting. And when I had classes and taught people, I'd say, you know, it's a lot cheaper than therapy. Because
and you end up with something very beautiful to wear.
You do, yeah.
It does something very similar to this common craze for coloring.
Mm, yes.
Which puts you in a meditative state, and the beading can put you in a meditative state. So it's another way of calming down all that's coming in from everything outside of you and letting your inside out.
But they're it's not just a string of beads, these incredible collars. These are complex.
Oh, and some are in sterling and some are...
Yeah, but the complexity of the collars, I mean, call them collars because they're not just a strand of beads. These are amazing tapestries done in beads, if you will. How do you manage to get the strings woven together into this incredible work of art?
It depends on what type of a pattern you're working with, but sometimes it simply starts with a whole strand of these little itty-bitty seed beads that are just a few millimeters big. And then you pick up a bead and you come back through and you just keep working until you build a fabric or a tapestry of beads.
Now, you're an artist. I have to ask about inspiration. And in the wording of the different chapters, I picked up that you're inspired by visions, sun dogs, dreams, people.
Yeah.
A piece of something that you've picked up somewhere. Tell me about your inspiration and how it leads you somewhere beautiful.
Yeah, and sometimes it's really easy to pin to connect the dots, and other times it's not as easy to connect the dots. But a ring, a woman brought a stone that she had found in a river and wanted me to make her a piece of jewelry. And the river rock said it needed to be in river. It still needed to be in the water. Mm-hmm. And so I created a setting for that that would be reminiscent of the water it came from. And I tried to emulate that, the ripples of the water mm-hmm. over the stone. And I captured that in a ring for her.
And that mm-hmm. ring's in the book.
That ring is in the book, and I do remember it, having picked up millions of rocks in my time and have them all over my house. But you're right. It would have been beautiful in a ring, but it is in the stream. It is in the water now on your finger.
On your finger, exactly. And that was really what I was trying to capture. I think I actually did capture that where it belongs, and it is where it
mm-hmm.
belongs.
Mm-hmm.
Other things, sometimes it's color, or I want to play with texture.
Mm.
And sometimes you'll get beads of the same color but different finishes. So one will be a shiny finish and the other will be a matte finish. And what happens when you get different shaped beads of shiny finish and matte finish and you make a tapestry out of those, and what happens with the reflection and reflection of light on that? And you play with that until something beautiful emerges. And it's just most of it's an exploration. Mother has cleaned my bead shop many times, and she has filed boxes of my explorations because some of them never make it.
And there would be such a beautiful beginning, and I just wish to see the end, and it's filed.
What happened to make it into a file as opposed to something that you're willing to say, I like this, I'm going to keep it?
Well, I might start on something and it will lead me to, oh no, do it this way, or oh no, do it that way. Mm-hmm. And so there might be little bits and pieces that are leading to, say, something like GK, which is it's yellow with yellow pearls and different shades mm-hmm. of yellow beads and in a paisley pattern. And working the beads to get them to form into the swirls, mm-hmm. right? So you work a little bit, okay, maybe if I do it this way. And so now I have little bits and pieces and little sprays, mm-hmm. but they were that lead up to the big color.
So I have a question. What are you saving the little bits and pieces for then if they led to something else? Why are they still stored?
Because
stored them?
Well, yes, but they also may, in the future, lead to another inspiration you never know.
Okay. Thank you, because I didn't want to feel like I'd wasted my time.
Being the organizer.
Well,
tell me how you started, because I remember reading in the beginning that you started as an adult. I mean, you started, obviously, in early childhood with this creative mind. But how did you start You were in architecture school, and you...
No, she's an architect. I was a licensed architect.
I mean, you just started, is when I'm...
When I was an architect. I was actually licensed as
an
architect.
That's when you started doing jewelry?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
My son left the home and gave me an empty nest, and I cried. Anytime somebody said something nice to me, I would cry, because... Which was really an unusual response for me, because I'm so independent. And when I was raising this boy, never dreamed I would miss him when he left home. I thought that it would be a celebration. And it was a celebration, because he was doing something marvelous. He was going to Europe and doing a foreign exchange year. And I was really happy that he had this opportunity. But my house was really empty. And I never understood that empty nest syndrome until he left for his first senior year of high school. And so I rented out his bedroom. I know that you're going, okay, what does this have to do with beating? It really has nothing to do with beating, but the woman I rented it to was had a hobby of making hemp jewelry and tying knots. And so she would go from one day to the next, she couldn't remember how to tie the knots. And so I would teach her every day how to tie the same knot. And then she started taking me to, bead stores. But we didn't go to bead stores. We went to Walmart. It was like, okay. And then she found a good bead store. And so she took me to this good bead store. Mm-hmm. And I started buying beads and stringing beads. And frankly, was not an artist. I was a craftsperson. And maybe I was just noodling around. Maybe those are my early ideas of getting started. And most of my early work is nowhere. Nobody gets to see the early work. It really is not art.
It's student's work.
It was definitely student work. And then there was a time that I did something quite different from anything that I had seen. And I'm going, oh, maybe I'm crossing a threshold here. And then I put some beads together in the middle of the night in incandescent light, and it was gorgeous. The shape was gorgeous. In incandescent light, the colors went nicely together. And late at night, I finished it. I went to bed. I got up by the light of the day. It was the most god-awful, hideous color combination you can imagine.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that in your book, I believe.
I think I do. And so I went, trucked off to the bead store, and I found a much better combination, took it all apart and redid it, and go, oh, wait a minute, I'm getting somewhere here. And then from there, it just was like the box was bust open, and I could just experiment and play.
Well, and I had always said from the time she was very young that she was an artist, and then she had a very bad experience in school with an art teacher who damaged her, basically told her she wasn't an artist and damaged everything, so she didn't believe in herself at all and never thought of herself as an artist and became an architect. An artist architect. Also.
So is this in high school, in college, where this...
Junior high.
Junior high. Mm-hmm. You were a child.
I was a child.
And what had you made at this...
Well,
that's the only surviving thing, I believe, from the art class. Everything else has been destroyed by the teacher.
Destroyed?
Yes. And what we're looking at is, would you call
it
a mask?
A mask, yeah.
A face mask.
In clay, yeah.
Yeah. And we did a lot of different things. I mean, the assignments were to do, we did many, many different things in art. But he would slash drawings and
throw clay on the floor.
Yeah.
Did he treat other students this way, or were you selected especially?
I believe he treated a lot of students this way.
And no one complained.
And my understanding, well, it's really interesting. Even after I wrote the book, I talked to a colleague of his. We started talking, who was also an artist. And he said to me that this teacher Should not have been allowed to teach after his wife died, but he used to be a very kind and generous teacher, and he lost his wife, and something happened to him, and he became very bitter and very angry, and he couldn't give to the students like he had in previously.
And very cruel.
And he became, yes, he did. But understanding that as an adult and an artist and recognized as one, it tempers the feeling even from what I had when I wrote the story. Because understanding the backstory of somebody else, you can forgive and you can be more generous that they're not just a freaking ass, you know. There's something more.
And you are not what they tell you you are.
Right.
It's their story.
It's their story. It's not about me. It's about them and about their loss. Yes. And we can really feel sad for his loss.
Yes.
And that he didn't have the strength or the knowledge or the ability to move from what he had always done into something new.
Or the exterior resources.
Or the
exterior
resources.
Because back in those days, there wasn't anybody in our town. We didn't have psychiatrists.
And you don't talk about... And in that day, you did not talk about death.
Yeah.
It was just a taboo subject. And I know this because my sister had died many years before that. Mm. And nobody would let me talk about her. Mm. And that was a very difficult experience to
overcome. Not only that, the family didn't talk about it.
No, nobody.
We just accepted that she, or did our best to accept the fact that she was dead.
That there was a big hole.
There's a big hole. And there's no discussion about it. Mm-hmm. So there's no healing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that he may have gone through many of those similar things.
Yeah.
So you can be generous to him now.
Yes, I can. After I found out what the backstory was.
And knowing that he was so wrong.
And knowing that he was so wrong.
I feel sad for other, perhaps, potential artists that he crushed and who didn't recover.
Yes.
From his opinion. Mm-hmm.
And I suspect, just with the backstory, that what he was shoving off and ruining were things that he thought, if this person just had a little more knowledge, a little more experience, this would be good, but it doesn't have it.
Or they know that they can be better. This person's really good, they can be better.
And so, smash it.
You can do better.
And not realizing that that can crush
a child.
A child. Certainly. Or not even being, not even thinking in those terms because you're focused on your own pain.
Right. So how have you guys managed to get where you are around this hole in your lives? I'm wondering if it affects your art in any way.
I'm sure it does. But I don't know how. Mother and I I turned around 25 perhaps. And it was close to my sister's birthday. Mm. And I said to my mother and I were at a department store or something. Not even that, like a Gibson's, when Gibson's was in town.
Yes.
And I said, you know, we both are thinking about her. Let's go celebrate her life. And that was the first time we talked about it. We went and had birthday lunch for my sister.
And we've had many, many birthday lunches since then on her birthday.
On her birthday, yeah.
Because you always think of and always remember that person. Because when somebody so close to you dies, they're never gone. You just learn how to live
without their physical
them
presence.
Being far away. It's no different than you living in Boston and me living here, excepting that we get telephone conversations.
Yeah.
And that's about the only difference. Excepting she'll always be 7. Mm-hmm.
That's not necessarily true for me.
That's true.
I dream of what she could have been. I do.
She might have been.
I dream about what she would be as an adult.
Uh-huh.
I dream about the strength of her character. Yeah. And her inner beauty, I mean, she was a gorgeous little girl, don't get me wrong, but she had this inner beauty and this inner character.
And she was so artistic and bright.
And I always thought that I was the child that should have died, that my parents would not have mourned as deeply. Mm-hmm. And it took me until we talked about it in my 20s to realize that it really wouldn't have mattered which child died.
No. Yeah, really.
We're all irreplaceable.
Yes. But when I was 10, I didn't think that.
It's a normal way to think at 10.
At 10, it was all about me and my pain and not anybody else's. And having the opportunity to talk to Mother about my sister and just our differences. I would get in the water and try to swim. Could I swim in a straight line across the pool? Absolutely not. My sister sat at the edge of the pool for 3 or 4 swimming sessions, like 3 or 4 weeks of swimming. And at the
end, a full session I paid for, and she never got in.
Second session comes up, and she's sitting by the pool, and Mother says, I'm not paying for a third unless you learn how to do the dead man's float. By the end of that session, she was swimming across the pool in a straight line.
and I still couldn't.
Yeah.
And you were mad at her for that.
Nope, I never was. No, I was not jealous. I was never. I didn't even know about that she could do better than I could.
But you've given her form now.
She's.
I don't even want to call it form, but there is a sort of. You've graced her with a life, in a sense.
Yeah.
By the way you envision her now.
Yeah. She's
very.
Yeah. Beautiful. And we can envision her as an adult. Sure. But the other thing is, you said you sank, but you never sank. She could go from one end of the pool going the short way and end up at the long end of the pool. She just couldn't go in a straight line, but she never sank. She never sank. She just couldn't go in a straight line, and she still doesn't. Mm. You look at her artwork, it does not go in straight lines unless it was really intended to.
Well, most art doesn't go in straight lines. The creative process doesn't go in a straight line.
It never
does. You end up with, how did I come up with that? And there it is.
Yes. So. Well, and my life, I think, is definitely the crooked path.
Much more interesting.
Yeah.
So how did all this affect your writing? Because part of what's beautiful about this book is your writing.
It forced me. But my life, I've always written. And I don't know how that specifically affects my writing, because I've never been able to write about her directly. I'm always writing in some other venue. Like even when we talk about her here, it's another venue. I have used death in my novels. I've never written articles on death, but I've used death of children in short stories and in articles. And so it's a theme that I've used, but I've never been able to write directly about her. She
comes in the sideways.
Yeah. I think for both of us.
Yeah.
She, you know, for somebody who only lived 7 years, she has dominated our lives in many ways. Mm-hmm. She was such an impressive human being. Mm-hmm. But so was Souther.
I was going to say, I'm thinking.
Even, you know, and I have a picture of the two of them sitting in this little nook in the house that we were living in Hamilton. And when I see the picture, and one very blonde and one with auburn hair and brown eyes and blonde hair and these wonderful, wonderful gray-green eyes. And I have the same awe that I felt when they were little. And just 3 years apart, so different, but so equally talented and brilliant, that I got, out of me came this.
Did a good job, Diane.
Thank you.
So moving back as we're finishing up here, to your art, do you have a sense of where you want to go now, of what's next? Does it just happen, or do you have a sense of, if I could do anything I wanted right now, I would do blank, blank, blank?
I'm working on a much bigger design right now that will be wearable and perhaps cover a whole body.
Tell me more. Whoa. I like that.
Well, I'm not quite sure where it's going yet. But I've been playing.
You're on an adventure.
I'm on an adventure. And I have a model for my design. And thank God she's really tiny.
No one else will be able to wear it.
That's okay.
It's a piece of art.
It's a piece of art.
It's a sculpture.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say too much more because what I have in my mind right now is probably not going to be anything like what it ends up.
Mm-hmm. Right, it will grow.
It's going to grow and morph and
it's like my
and
stories.
I don't know where it's going to end up, but I have a gown in mind.
But
I don't know that it's going to be a gown.
But that's just like writing. I develop the characters. I don't know where they're going.
Yeah.
But it's amazing where they go.
They lead you somewhere.
And yeah. So maybe that's art. Mm-hmm. In just two different venues.
Well, the spirit of play and adventure play a big part in any kind of art.
And that's just life.
If we could only all learn that. The spirit of play, and let's see where this takes me. That will be fun. Anything else you'd like to say, or I haven't asked a question you wished I'd asked?
Oh, heavens. I never had any anticipation of what you might ask.
My either, but I would like to tell people that if they're interested in the book, they can find it online at thesouthergroup.com.
Southergroup.com. That's S-O-U.
Starts out with the, T-H-E.
Oh, T-H-E, thesouthergroup.com.
.com. Yep.
Souther is spelled S-O-U-T-H-E-R, which is a creative and beautiful name. Souther.
It's her great-grandmother's last name.
Is it?
Yes,
a wonderful
and
name.
She was a big influence in my life, as Souther is a big influence in my life today.
Thank you for this lovely conversation.
Thank you both very much.